မ္မာနိုင်ငံဆိုင်ရာအမေရိကန်ဥပဒေမူကြမ်းဘာမာ Act of 2021ကိုအမေရိကန်အောက်လွှတ်တော်ကနေပြီးတော့ April 6ရက်နေ့မှာအတည်ပြုလိုက်ပါတယ်
အမေရိကန်သမ္မတလက်မှတ်ချိုးလို့ဥပဒေအတည်ဖြစ်လာရင်အမေရိကန်ပြည်ထောင်စုကမြန်မာဒီမိုကရေစီအရေးကိုပို့ပြီးထိထိရောက်ရောက်ကူညီနိုင်မယ်လို့မျှော်လင့်နေကြပါတယ
်မြန်မာအရေးနဲ့ပတ်သက်ပြီး Brief Burma Act လို့ခေါ်တဲ့ဥပဒေအတည်တရက်ကိုအမေရိကန်အောက်လွှတ်တော်မှအတည်ပြုပြဋ္ဌာန်းနိုင်ဖို့စ조사နေတယ်လို့သိရပါတယ်
You're listening to a special series from the Inside Myanmar podcast, where we're examining a quiet but deeply consequential move. The United States Treasury's Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, recently removed several Myanmar military-linked individuals and entities from its sanction list. These delistings have sparked urgent questions about accountability, the direction of U.S. foreign policy,and what message this sends both the military junta and democratic resistance. Regional arms trafficking, illicit finance, and rare earth mineral extractions are all on the rise with consequences that stretch far beyond Myanmar's borders. In this series, we're speaking with lawmakers, legal experts, human rights advocates, and voices from Myanmar's frontline struggle to unpack what happened, why it matters,And what comes next with that? Let's listen to the episode that follows.
Today I'm joined with a guest who has been a long time coming for me as an interviewer, Simon Bilinas, a pretty significant name in the Myanmar space, probably very familiar to most of our audience. We're going to be talking about obviously the sanctions that have been lifted recently, but more broadly what Congress is doing in the United States and how that's going to impact Myanmar. But before we get into that, Simon, for those of our audience who maybe are not familiar with you and are not familiar with your advocacy work, please introduce yourself however you see fit.
Sure, thank you. My name is Simon Bilinas, and I'm currently a director of Campaign for a New Myanmar. And this is one of a series of hats that I've worn working on Burma for the last 30 years, actually.
Impressive. So let's dive right in. So first, with these sanctions, we've been talking about these for a while now. So the big news, obviously, is that approximately a week ago, at time of recording, the United States announced that they were lifting certain sanctions on individuals and organizations that were associated with the military. And there's been a lot of speculation of what that means, where it comes from, whose decision that was. And obviously, there have been a lot of allegations, though, this is Donald Trump's doing because they flattered him, the military flattered him a letter, and back and forth on that point. But I'm wondering what insight you can bring into what the motivation for lifting these sanctions might have been from your perspective.
I mean, I think it's becoming sort of clearer the reason for the dropping of these sanctions. I mean, when this happened, frankly, I was very surprised to see these see this delisting, and obviously very concerned as well. I think it's become clearer that the sanctioned people and companies employed a lobbyist here in Washington, D.C. to make the case to get them off the list. I can't really speculate as to what was, the ultimate reason as to why these sanctions were dropped. I mean, we're still kind of finding that out right now, but it definitely came at it was a very discordant action coming in the same week as we got three of our Burma bills through key House committees earlier that week on the Tuesday. I think people are feeling kind of whipsawed by the good news at the beginning of the week and then this bad news at the end of the week. And it kind of really feeds into this feeling of uncertainty that we have here in Washington, D.C., not just around Burma policy, but around, policy generally, is that, we're dealing with a very unpredictable, capricious administration that's not bound by precedent, is not bound by past policy. And so Burma policy is in the same status of foreign policy flux in Washington, D.C., as we see with so many other issues and so many other aspects of government policy. So I kind of analogized at the beginning of this second Trump administration. I said, I think you got to imagine that Burma policy is this tiny little boat on this incredibly, unprecedentedly stormy ocean that is American politics and the Trump administration. And there's these huge waves we haven't seen before. And we have no control over those waves. But all we can do is try to steer our little boat that is Burma policy and try to stay afloat. So I mean, that's the situation that we're in. And that week when we got our three Burma bills through Congress, and then we saw these sanctions dropped. I mean, that was just another example of the kind of whipsaw that we're seeing here in DC, not just on Burma, but on a whole range of other policies.
I can imagine. And we're certainly going to spend, I think, the lion's share of our discussion on those three bills and their content and the prognosis for them. But I do wonder on this point, obviously, the number of times we've been able to use the term unprecedented with reference to announcements that have been coming out of the Trump administration is a little bit disconcerting. But I do wonder, is there, so to speak, a sort of fourth branch developing here? Because ostensibly in the United States and many Western countries, there's this tripartite division of powers. You've got your legislative, executive, and your judiciary. But it sort of feels like with certain elements of foreign policy, and certainly it appears on the surface that the sanctions are among them, it's not decisions being made by Congress or the legislature. It's not decisions being made by the executive, nor indeed decisions being made by any judicial body, but rather decisions being made by the civil administration itself, seemingly independent of the three canonical branches of government. Is there a bit of a sense in which there's this fourth, almost autonomous momentum within American politics as regards Myanmar foreign policy?
That's a good question. I mean, let me sort of pull it back a little bit more, based on, the 30 years I have for some reason spent working on Burma. and seeing how Washington operates from from the inside and also from the outside, half of that time I was based in Boston, and so I was organizing, lobbying of Congress, from the grassroots level. And now, having moved to Washington, D.C. in 2006, now I'm getting like kind of more of the inside view of Washington. I would say a couple of things. I mean, when it comes to Burma policy, I mean, it's a very, very small fishbowl, and kind of everybody knows each other. I think that, so pulling it back a little bit, I've always viewed U.S. foreign policy as being based on 2.5 priorities. And U.S. foreign policy is a function of, one, U.S. national security interests. Number two, U.S. commercial interests. And that little half priority is democracy and human rights. And so for a lot of the time, with regard to Burma policy, is that we who are trying to inject a bit of concern about human rights and democracy into U.S. foreign policy, we've been for many years battling U.S. corporate interests, particularly companies like Chevron, which was the largest U.S. investor in Burma. And prior to that, Chevron became the U.S. largest U.S. investor in Burma when they bought Unocal, which built the Adana pipeline starting in the early 90s. I approached this back in the early 90s when I worked at a socially responsible investment firm called Trillium Asset Management. And what I did there was for basically the 1990s, the whole decade, I developed a number of sort of new human rights campaigns using shareholder pressure and shareholder advocacy to put pressure on companies. And I worked with folks working on Burma in Washington, D.C. and civil society groups and others to kind of integrate that into the broader field of the free Burma, free Myanmar movement. And the first company that we really tussled with was Unocal. We're in a sort of constant battle with Unocal and later with Chevron, because after the 1988 crackdown on the democracy movement, in 1989, the Myanmar junta was broke. They needed cash, and one of the ways they did that was they opened up areas of Burma, both onshore and offshore, to oil and gas exploration, and that netted them a number of signing bonuses, fees to explore, millions of dollars, just to the oil companies like Unocal and Texaco and Amoco and Arco paid to Total of France. They paid millions of dollars for the rights to explore in Burma, and some of those led to finds like the Adana gas fields, which were developed by Total and Unocal, later Chevron. And so we were really, one of the things I did, first of all, was organize the filing of the first shareholder resolutions at companies doing business in Burma. And the first resolutions that we filed, this was in 1993, were at Texaco, Unical, Amoco, and Pepsi. Because there was, if you remember, there was a whole boycott of Pepsi because Pepsi's bottler in Burma was a noted junta crony, Thein Tan. Anyway, but, and so a lot of the time we've been in the Free Burma movement have been kind of integrating two things. One is, this is what I still do today as, you know, director of Campaign for New Myanmar, is that we organize grass tops and grassroots lobbying of Congress. And by that, I mean, the grass tops is those of us who are in D.C. I live on Capitol Hill. I literally walk down to congressional offices and have meetings with congressional staffers and ask them to co-sponsor bills. And with a variety of other folks, we pull a lot of people together, you know, people from the American Baptist Church and people from Utah University Service Committee, all kinds of other groups. You know, we're all working together to do this kind of grass tops lobbying. And then we also organize grass roots lobbying of Congress. We have an email list of 19,000 people in the U.S. And actually, because we send people every week online actions where they can simply click and send a message directly to their members of Congress and ask them to take action on Burma, usually co-sponsoring one of the bills like the Brave Burma Act, the Burma Gap Act. So we're kind of organizing a pincer movement where members of Congress, you know, hear from us in D.C. face-to-face, and at the same time they're continually hearing from their constituents, from the voters in their district, who are also asking them to take action and co-sponsor bills. So that's one thing that we do. The other thing that we do is we organize what's called market-based campaigns of pressure on companies. And by market-based campaigns, I'm talking about shareholder pressure, consumer pressure, and media pressure, particularly social media pressure, aimed at companies that have an investment in their brands, in their image, in their reputation. And we try to integrate that too, because, you know, one of the things that where these two overlap have always overlapped has been with sanctions. And so at the same time we, you know, back in the 90s, the 2000s, early 2000s, when we were lobbying for sanctions on Burma and going after companies that, provided key amounts of support or money for the junta, we were facing a counter lobby that was primarily Chevron and before that Unical and Texaco. For instance, the first sanctions that we got on Burma back in 96 we got enough congressional pressure on the administration to get a ban on new investment by U.S. companies in Burma. That was triggered in 97 by President Clinton. And I think one of the key things around that is that that was a ban on new investment in Burma, right? Because the lobbyists for Unical and the lobbyists for Texaco wanted to make sure that their investments in Burma were grandfathered in and were not affected by those sanctions. And so that was that was all that we were able to get from Congress at that time, was that that ban on new investment in Burma. But that was very significant politically because, again, it got Congress in support of sanctions on Burma, and that was enough to trigger President Clinton to issue this ban on new investment in Burma using what's called IEPA, the International Emergency Powers Act. And so that sanction, it wasn't written into law, but it was executed. It was implemented by executive action. Okay, so you know, so in this bigger picture, what we're doing here and what we've done for 30 years is that we have put pressure on the administration, whatever the administration is, to impose these sanctions on Burma and to more specifically impose sanctions on the junta. And we've achieved that through pressure from Congress. If there's one thing I've learned in 30 years doing this, is that whoever the administration is, they don't act on Burma unless there's pressure from Congress. And this is why we created the Congressional Burma Caucus. This is why we work with our champions in Congress to introduce bills and to pass bills, because these bills that we see, these are the tip of the spear of congressional pressure that gets the administration to act. If you look at the Brave Burma Act, it doesn't actually write any sanctions into law, but it does put pressure on the administration to specifically to sanction Myanmar Economic Bank, and also to put pressure on to sanction foreign companies involved in the sale of aviation fuel to the junta. And that's fine. That's how DC works, is that you don't tend to get many sort of sanctions written into law, because oftentimes you don't actually need to do that. It just takes the administration to see that Congress is coalescing around a specific bill or a specific resolution, or they're receiving letters from key senators, key representatives, urging specific things. And that is enough pressure on the administration to take that kind of action and to do things like enact sanctions by executive action. I mean, maybe that's gotten into the weeds a little bit there, but that's how the overall process works here in DC. So, I mean, I think there's like an ongoing conversation in DC amongst the tiny few people in DC, either in Congress, either in administration, or in advocacy NGOs, or in corporations who are interested in safeguarding their investments in Burma. So there's a continual conversation in DC around this, and you see it. You see it sort of manifest itself in think tank webinars and in congressional hearings and in remarks that are made by the Secretary of State and so forth. And maybe that's what you're kind of referring to at the beginning of this conversation, is that there's this continual conversation, which is kind of like the kind of like the electrical charge that's going through this sort of circuitry, which is the sort of underpinnings of power here in Washington, D.C. Mm.
Because it's interesting that you call it a conversation, because from the outside perspective, having Congress putting what we can, very simple terms, we can say Congress putting forth pro-Burmese democracy action on the same week that we have OFAC and Treasury lifting these sanctions in a move that we would consider to be anti-Burmese democracy. I know that's a very simplistic label to put on it. That sort of looks from the outside that it's not so much that there is a complex ongoing conversation happening. It appears from the outside that there is in fact no conversation happening, and one hand does not know what the other is doing, and indeed one hand might be working contrary to what the other hand is trying to accomplish. And so that's that. This, on this point then, the way that you're saying that Congress is able to advance a bill in order to put pressure on the executive, is Congress able to do that in order to put pressure on these civil service sectors, things like OFAC and Treasury? Are those things that they can lobby? Because I know you're talking about the executive ability to sanction, but these particular sanctions did not come through executive orders. They just seem to have been handled purely internally and administratively. So does Congress still have the ability to make it clear to these guys that, hey, we want America to go in a certain direction foreign policy-wise, and we expect you to come along? Or is each department its own little fief, and they're saying, I don't care what your policy is, I'm pursuing my policy?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'll say one thing. You know, I know when we sit down with staff at like State Department and Treasury, and we're making the case for sanctions, I'm always pleased to hear that. You know, when I'm always pleased to find out that these State Department or Treasury officials, they always know at any given point, for instance, just how many co-sponsors the Burma bills have. They'll make a point saying like, oh yeah, you picked up some more co-sponsors. So that to me tells me that they are hearing. They're keeping a pulse on what's going on in Congress. I mean, one of the things you also don't see is there's continual conversation between congressional offices and the administration, and so you know what also hits the public is, you know, when a bill is introduced, or when, you know, Representative Bill Azenga speaks to his bill in the House Foreign Financial Services Committee, you know, when he questions Secretary Rubio or Secretary Besant, and likewise. But what you're not seeing is the continual communication that's going between congressional offices and the administration, where they are they're weighing in privately with the administration, and that is part of the conversation too. That's like the bottom 9/10 of the iceberg, right? Mm. You know, you're seeing like the tip of the iceberg on the top, but there's a whole like 9/10 of the iceberg under the water that you're not seeing just by kind of looking in DC from the outside.
Mm, fair enough. And I mean, I assume that's inevitably going to be the case for us as external commentators, looking at DC as a black box where announcements and policy come out and lobbying goes in, but we don't understand the nuts and the bolts of it. It's going to be very difficult to come to a reasonable conclusion about what's going on behind the scenes. So we're very grateful to have this type of insight. And so let's turn then to those bills. So you're saying three bills got through select committees, and I'll give you the chance first to just brief us quickly on what the three bills are before we get into depth on all of them. But then I'm also going to ask you about select committees themselves, because I know a lot of our audience are familiar with American political processes, but a lot of them aren't. And I want to make sure that we understand exactly where in the process these are and what can be expected in their future. But so before we get into that, can you give us in brief what these three bills are?
Certainly. First of all, there's the Brave Burma Act, and this is essentially a sanctions bill, and it puts pressure on the administration to, by executive action, sanction Myanmar oil and gas enterprises, Myanmar Economic Bank, and also foreign companies involved in the sale of jet fuel to the junta. It also contains a provision that would make it more difficult for the junta to represent Burma at the World Bank and IFC. So, but it's essentially a sanctions bill. There's also another bill on the sanctions side, the No New Funds for Burma Act. That would direct the U.S. representative on the IBRD to use the U.S.'s voice and use the U.S.'s vote not to disperse any funds to Burma as long as the junta is in control of the country. So those are the two sanctions bills, and those went through the House Financial Services Committee, specifically because they're sanctions bills. Okay. The second bill is the Burma Genocide Accountability and Protection Act. And this last session was the Rohingya Genocide Accountability and Protection Act. But this time, the bill is a little bit more broader beyond focusing on the Rohingya. And for instance, it includes authorization of money to investigate atrocities, not just against the Rohingya, but also against other ethnic groups in Burma. And that bill is kind of two things. It is one, it is, as a matter of policy, it is Congress putting pressure on the administration to support the use of sort of international accountability mechanisms to hold the junta accountable for the atrocities and crimes against humanity and the genocide that it has committed in Burma. It also authorizes money for the survivors of genocide and mass atrocities. And so it authorizes considerable humanitarian assistance for Rohingya refugees, but also other refugees from Burma, from other ethnic groups. So that, and also it's the bill now that contains the language calling for a special envoy, special coordinator to coordinate Burma policy. And so that, because it's a foreign policy bill, that went to the House Foreign Affairs Committee and was marked up and considered and voted out by that committee.
Mm. Okay, so that's all right. That's a beautiful overview, and I'm really excited to jump into each of these, and then specifically also to jump into the interplay between these, because I think there are some very interesting possibilities there. But so let's talk about these. So there are two select committees that we're talking about. So you said the Home Financial Services Committee dealt with the first two bills because those are largely sanctions and sanctions adjacent. And so it's gone through, it has been approved by the committee, and there's a separate committee for for the genocide accountability one, which has also gone through. So what does it actually mean for a bill to have gone to a select committee and to be passed by that select committee?
It is a sign that there is significant congressional support for these bills. The Brave Burma Act and the No New Funds for Burma Act, those two bills passed the House Financial Services Committee unanimously.
Wow.
Yeah.
How large is this committee, by the way?
It's got about close to 50.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And the in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, the Burma Gap Act passed by a vote of 44-5.
Wow.
And in both committees, you saw the Republican chair and the Democratic ranking member both urge the committees to vote in favor of the bills. Now, this is very much by design. One of the things that we've done for the last 30 years is that we have always tried and we have succeeded in keeping the issue of Burma here in DC a bipartisan issue with both Republican champions and Democratic champions, to the extent that we've been able to get good Burma policy out of Congress's control by either the Republicans or the Democrats, and we've been able to get good action from presidents, whether they're Republican or Democratic. And any advocacy campaign, that is effective works on a bipartisan basis. And I'm very pleased that we've been able to do that and continue to do that. So I think the bipartisan nature of this, overwhelming or indeed unanimous approval by these key committees of these bills, that sends a very clear message to the administration that, this is not an issue that is getting caught up in the, ever worsening partisan polarization that we're seeing here in Washington, D.C. When we meet with congressional staffers, one of the things that we like to say is Burma is one of the few issues in D.C. right now that is bipartisan. And that's very much appreciated. That's why we've made, we're making so much progress. So right now, where these bills are in the process is both of these bills need to be now taken up by the House of Representatives as a whole. And so we'll be working to get these bills lined up for a floor vote and get them passed out of the House. At the same time, we're working right now with a number of Senate offices, because we also want to introduce both of these bills in the Senate. We were not able to do that last session. I have to say, we came within a couple of days of introducing the Rohingya Gap Act in the Senate, it was going to be introduced by Senator Jeff Merkley and Senator Marco Rubio, and we'd gotten both offices, pretty much agreed on the language, and we're hoping to, at the very least, get this introduced in the kind of late November, early December, just so that we could, get one of these bills introduced in the Senate for the first time. But then we had the election. We had Senator Rubio nominated to be Secretary of State. And then, you know, I get a call back from Senator Rubio staffer saying, Simon, sorry, obviously now Senator Rubio is not going to be moving forward with co-sponsoring any bills. So, but we were that close. We were like within a couple of days. So frustrating. But
very unpredictable these days in Washington.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the saying here is like, you know, we just have to roll with the punches. You know, it's just every day is something new and unexpected. So anyway, so we're working to get, you know, both the Brave Burma Act and the Burma Gap Act introduced in the Senate. But the other thing, you know, the way legislation moves in DC these days is that it's hard to get a freestanding bill through Congress. And so what a lot of people do is they'll take language from the bills and attach them to a must-pass bill, like, for instance, an appropriations bill.
Is that really a thing that happens?
Oh, that's how we got the Burma Act passed.
I remember that.
Yeah, if you remember, the Burma Act passed the House, but it got stuck in the Senate, didn't get through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And so, what Representative Meeks did was he attached language from the Brave Burma Act to the National Defense Authorization Act, which is essentially the defense budget. It's a bit more complicated than that, but I think for the sake of this explanation, it's the defense budget. So language in the Burma Act was attached to the National Defense Authorization Act in the House, and then included in the Senate version and in the final version, the final reconciled version that passed Congress. And that's how we got the Burma Act into law. It was an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act. So what you're going to see in September is you're going to see language from these bills attached to most likely either the State Department Reauthorization Act and or, again, the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA.
I think it's just a little bit upsetting for me. I'm listening to a man who clearly is deeply engaged with Congress telling me that what I thought was a throwaway storyline on a Simpsons episode 20 years ago, where the only way they could pass a bill was to get the chief opposition too drunk to vote and attach it to a Flags for Orphans bill that was guaranteed to fly through Congress, is in fact reality. That is how the political establishment apparently operates. This is just a little bit of a pulling back the curtain moment for me. I'm a little aghast. I'm not going to lie. Even though you're saying this is a bipartisan supported bill, this is something that both sides seem to like. You're just saying as a freestanding piece of legislation, even though both sides like it, they wouldn't pass it.
I mean, I think you got to look when it comes to Burma, you've got to look at this as the primary opponent we have in passing Burma-related legislation is not any particular counter lobby. It is simply apathy, inertia, and ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have, you know, broad support in Congress for this. But it's you have to get through the apathy, the ignorance, and just the inertia, and, you know, advocates on any issue, you know, here in DC or working on DC, know that the legislative process and the appropriations process here in DC is fundamentally broken. And these are the workarounds that we have to use to get things done.
Fair enough. And I also noticed in your description, when you were talking about the Burma bill, you mentioned the Senate committee. So my imagination had been that there is only one committee stage, that a bill goes to committee, then it goes to the lower house, then it goes to the upper house, and then it goes to the president to be signed. But so is it then the case that there are two layers of committees, one for each house?
Yep, we deal with the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Yes.
Okay, and both committees would have to sign off on it for their respective houses to agree.
That is correct.
Ah, okay. So, and so because the way that we were talking about the House Committee, the implication there being that, well, if the House Committee pushes it through, and as you say, you have both the Republican head of the or the chair of the committee and also the senior Democrat both voicing support for it, is that not indicative that Democrats of both houses and Republicans of both houses would support it? It feels almost redundant to send it to two committees for this sort of litmus testing.
I think you may be onto a good point about the unwieldiness of bicameral legislatures right there.
Ah. Fair enough.
from a Brit where we, I'm British originally, and so I'm used to having a parliament where, one chamber, the House of Commons is predominant, and yeah, the House of Lords is just notional exactly, but that's not the case here in the U.S. Mm. I mean, we have a powerful House and we have a powerful Senate.
Yes,
and you need both to get things done.
But I just always imagined that as far as the actual culture of politics in the United States is concerned. So I live in Australia, and certainly in Australia, yes, the Senate is more likely to give more critical analysis, is more likely to give critical pushback. But it is still generally the case that party affiliation is more important than House. Senators are a little bit more free to cross the floor. But as a general rule, you would anticipate that if you have a majority of both houses, you will be pushing legislation through all day, every day, because you simply can. And it seems that from what you're saying, that in the United States, there is a significant divide between the people in the Senate and the people in the House of Representatives, which is possibly strong enough to rival their party affiliations and their party loyalties.
That is correct. That is correct in a lot of aspects. Although, in the U.S. right now, we're seeing because of the political polarization, you're seeing in many respects Congress to be, either losing or just freely giving up a number of its powers to the administration. But that, in the case of Burma policy, as I said, we've always kept this a bipartisan issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's allowed us to, sidestep, these, growing partisan divides that you're seeing here in Washington D.C. and sort of in the broader country as well of the U.S.
Hmm. Fair enough. So let's turn then back to the actual bills themselves and the implications of them. So let's start with the Brave Burma Act. That is meaty. That's the only way I could really describe that. So MOGE, Myanmar Oil and Gas Enterprises, that I remember being a huge sticking point. Even back when we were talking about the Burma bill, special exemptions for MOGE were carved out. I know Chevron would have had something to do with that behind the scenes. So are we now in a place where the United States is willing to just really double down and say MOGE and you're saying the Economic Bank are going to be sanctioned or at least sanctionable? We're not interested in protecting them, whether or not there are interests in those. And then the jet fuel that we've been advocating for years and years and years and years that everyone has been hiding behind by saying, oh, it's a dual use commodity. We can't regulate whether or not they're buying civilian jet fuel or military jet fuel. Therefore, we can't sanction it. We can't limit it. Is also finally going to see some serious action. Is this piece of legislation really as consequential as it looks? Because this looks like an enormous leap forward.
Yeah, and I think it's consequential in broader aspects too, because as I said, the administration, any administration, is watching and listening to Congress very clearly, and you know, as I said, you know, earlier, the these bills are kind of like the tip of the spear of congressional pressure on the administration, and they're really designed to put enough congressional pressure on the administration to enact these sanctions by executive action. You know, the Brave Burma Act does not write these sanctions into law. It merely puts pressure on the administration to do these sanctions, MEB, MOGI, by executive action. And that's fine. And so realizing that, you know, these bills do not have to pass in order to put enough pressure on the administration to act. These bills simply have to progress enough that it puts sufficient pressure on the administration, and then we would get those sanctions on MEB and MOGI. An additional
sanction. That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that is how it has worked. I mean, all the sanctions that we have seen on the junta, you know, since August 2017, you know, right after the Rohingya genocide that wave that started in August of 2017, the first sanctions on the junta were enacted by the first Trump administration. Mm. You know, the Rohingya genocide determination was under very careful consideration by the Trump administration right up to the end. And in the end, they decided to issue the Uyghur genocide determination, but not the Rohingya genocide determination. And it wasn't until the Biden administration and after the coup that we had the Rohingya genocide determination. But again, you know, we had been mobilizing congressional pressure on the first Trump administration, most notably through the Rohingya Genocide Determination Act that we had in the House, which. That legislation later was the basis for the Burma Act that was introduced after the coup. So you'll see, you can actually see since, you know, August 2017, you can see increasing sanctions taken by executive action by the Trump administration, then the Biden administration, and now we're back with the Trump 2 administration, and we're continuing that process and continuing to build that congressional pressure. So there is some continuity there, which I think is encouraging. But again, the way this works, the way that we are organizing power to affect U.S. policy on Burma is that we're organizing people all across the U.S. to ask their members of Congress to step up and co-sponsor these bills. And as these bills gain more co-sponsors and progress through Congress, that in turn puts pressure on the administration to act. And that is how we are organizing power from the grassroots upwards to get the kind of burn policies that we want from the U.S. government.
Now, I do want to clarify on this point, because having spoken to Sean Turnell a few days ago, we did investigate this point of the interaction between the executive branch and the sanctions. And the thrust of what he was saying that I've alluded to in this discussion is that the executive does have the authority to simply decree certain things. He can simply make sanctions. But for the most part, the decision to lay sanctions and to lift sanctions seems to be handled rather autonomously by OFAC and Treasury. So the big question here is, when you talk about the existence of these bills and these moments of bipartisan support for these bills being an effective tool to lobby the executive, my question is that pressure on the executive going to, as it were, trickle down to OFAC and Treasury? Or is the hope purely that, regardless of what OFAC and Treasury were planning to do anyway, the executive is going to directly step in and say, no, I'm going to lead the charge in a sanctions regime through executive orders?
I think, you know, there's not... You've got to realize that the State Department, the Treasury, OFAC, part of the Treasury, these are all part of the administration. And so when Congress is putting pressure on the administration, it's putting pressure on state, it's putting pressure on Treasury, it's putting pressure on OFAC, it's putting pressure on the White House, on the National Security Council. It's all of a piece.
Mm. Okay. So they are all speaking, they are all communicating, they are all interconnected.
Yeah. I mean, whenever we have people like Sean Turnell and others who come to DC, one things that we do is we set up meetings with the White House, with the State Department, with Treasury, with key members of Congress for people. And when Sean was in town, we had meetings with Treasury officials, meetings with State Department officials. He had a meeting with the National Security Council at the White House staffers, and meetings with a number of our key congressional champions. And so, yeah, I mean, this is how we try to steer this, super tanker of a ship that is the U.S. government. It's by applying pressure from every direction that we can organize.
I understand that'd be the only way to get it done. So coming back to the bill itself, though, if the bill has this immense power just by existing, just by these gestures of, very vocal bipartisan support in the committee saying, yes, we love this bill, we want this bill to go through, we think other people in our party should also push this bill through. If that is powerful enough that you can have the bill and let the bill sort of ultimately not go anywhere, the question then is, is it something that we are comfortable with? Because the provisions in this bill that you've laid out here, like the sanctions on MOGE, the sanctions on jet fuel, the sanctions on the Economic Bank, these are enormous. These are very significant steps. Is it something where we're comfortable with the bill not going anywhere because the executive can simply do those things anyway? Or is it one of those cases where you also really do need this bill to ultimately succeed because of what it is offering?
I mean, I think the key thing here is to, and our key challenge is to use this bill as a vehicle to organize enough congressional pressure on the administration to act. now. And so this is why we are pushing these bills as far and as fast as we possibly can. This is why we're we want to demonstrate to the administration that there is growing power and growing momentum behind these bills, which there is right now. The Brave Burma Act was not marked up by the House Financial Services Committee last session. It didn't make it to markup. This session, we've got it through that committee. That is momentum. That is progress, and that is noticed. That is powerful. If we get these bills introduced in the Senate as freestanding bills in September, that shows additional momentum, additional progress. More than we had in the previous session. So that sends a very clear message and puts very clear pressure on the administration that Congress is, Congress, you know, wants these kinds of measures, wants these sanctions, and wants a more keenly focused Burma policy from the administration. I don't know whether it would take passing these bills to provide the necessary pressure, or it may be enough if we get these bills introduced in the Senate and show momentum that way, or it may be necessary to get language from these bills attached as an amendment to the NDAA or the state reauthorization bill. I'm not sure what amount of pressure is going to be enough. I can't predict that. All I know is that we are going to push these bills as far and as hard as we possibly can. And in so doing, continue to build our power in Congress, and so that with this administration and any administration moving forward, they know that Congress wants the U.S. to have a policy towards Burma that is putting increasing pressure on the junta and is providing increasing support to the democracy movement, to the ethnic resistance organizations, and really establish the Burmese communities in the U.S. and also friends of the Burmese communities in the U.S. as a powerful lobby here in Congress, with the administration, and in the country as a whole.
And I just want to clarify on the technical side of things, just so it's clear for myself and for everyone else. So if the bill goes to the Senate and the bill fails in the Senate, whether it's in the committee or whether it fails in the Senate itself, there's nothing after that precluding you from repurposing language from that and attaching it to something else. It's not like you only get one bite of the apple. You can have an earnest attempt to pass it through the Senate, and if that attempt fails, it doesn't mean that it's game over.
I mean, it really is both and then also other ways of putting congressional pressure on the administration. We're gonna push these freestanding bills again as far and as fast as we can. At the same time, where there's language attached to key bills like the NDAA and State Department Reauthorization Act, we will put pressure to get those to get members of Congress to support those amendments and get those through. And at the same time, we're also working with members of Congress on letters to the administration, what's called Dear Colleague letters to the administration, on specific items. We're also working to get members of Congress to weigh in on, weigh in with Congress on extending temporary protected status for Burmese refugees in the U.S. We're also, working with members of Congress to pose questions of administration figures at hearings. We're also working with them to speak out also through press releases and through social media. I mean, Congress has all of these tools beyond just legislation. Congress has all of these tools that it can use to pressure the administration. And we're going to continue working with our champions in Congress to use all of those tools. And we're also going to be continuing to work with Congress as a whole to increase the number of senators and representatives who are our champions, who are amongst those who will take leadership and, you know, in the House, join the Burma caucus and also be more active using all of these tools that they have at their disposal.
I suppose this is an organic and an appropriate juncture to ask, are there any particular members of Congress that you would like our audience to know about? We do have quite a few listeners in the United States. Any particular members of Congress that you think our audience members maybe should spend a little bit of time writing to, communicating to, congratulating for their efforts, or trying to lobby and petition to really highlight the significance of this issue?
Well, I think, you know, everyone in the U.S. should take the online actions that we and also Better Burma circulate that allow people to contact their members of Congress and urge them to co-sponsor the Brave Burma Act or the Burma Genocide Accountability and Protection Act. The more that people call and write and email their members of Congress to co-sponsor these bills, that is how you, as a resident of the U.S., can play your part and be effective in getting Congress and in turn the administration to be that support to the Burmese democracy movement. So, but you know, among our champions, you know, we have, you know, obviously our co-chairs of the Burma Caucus, Bella Zenga, a Republican from Michigan 4, and Betty McCollum, a Democrat from Minnesota 4. Both of those representatives have big Burmese communities in their districts in Battle Creek, Michigan, and in St. Paul, Minnesota. Also in the House, we've had tremendous support from Representative Gregory Meeks from New York City. He's the lead on the Burma Gap Act and was the lead on the Burma Act that we previously got passed. Two House representatives that have been terrific have been Representative Young Kim, Republican from California, and Representative Amy Berra, a Democrat also from California. They are the chair and the ranking member of the East Asia Pacific Subcommittee of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which, you know, covers Burma, and they've been exceptional champions of ours. And I also want to mention an excellent freshman Republican from Indiana, Jefferson Shreve, who is, I think he's one of the House members who's got one of the largest Burmese communities in his district, and I think he's going to be a rising star when it comes to being a champion in Congress. He's already doing quite a bit. And over in the Senate, Senator Jeff Merkley, Senator Todd Young, also from Indiana, Senator Van Hollen from Maryland, and Senator Grassley, Republican from Iowa. These are all among our champions in the Senate. And of course, Senator Mitch McConnell, who's been a longtime supporter of Aung San Suu Kyi. That's another office that we work with a lot, and he's been, you know, integral in getting the first sanctions on Burma way back in the 90s and early 2000s, and I think is still going to play a powerful role moving forward now that he's in his final years of his service in the Senate.
I appreciate it, and hopefully everyone does take that up and take those online actions that they can. For full disclosure, obviously, this podcast is a project of Better Burma, or is associated with Better Burma. I just want to make sure everyone's aware of that. But yeah, so moving then to the third bill that you had mentioned. Now, this is interesting, the genocide bill. So if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, essentially what this is now examining is not only the genocide against the Rohingya, which the United States has formally recognized as a genocide, very appropriately so, but is indeed looking at crimes against all ethnic minorities, but it does not extend to generally investigating crimes that the military might be committing against anyone in the civilian population. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing with the Burma Gap Act is it's a broadening of the language from last session when it was just the Rohingya Gap Act, and it's kind of I think it really kind of recognizes how you know, in Congress and sort of in the U.S. as a whole, advocates for the Rohingya having increasingly joined hands with advocates for other ethnic minorities in Burma, and also just advocates for the democracy movement in Burma. And I think it's a sign of, again, how everyone is increasingly coming together in opposition to the junta. I think that's a best way of describing how this bill has developed, and that's all to the good. One thing that is important to note is that the Representative Meeks, who is the sort of lead, who is the lead on the Rohingya Gap Act, he's also co-sponsored the Brave Burma Act. Mm. And Representative Bill Azenga, who's the lead on the Brave Burma Act, has also co-sponsored the Burma Gap Act. And so this is, part and parcel of how our champions in Congress from both the Republican side and the Democratic side are working even more closely together to get these bills through Congress and to provide support for every community and every ethnicity in Burma.
Hmm. And I do want to look at a little bit of what this act actually does. Whether or not this act ultimately makes it through Congress and becomes enacted as law, or whether its effect is just to push this general sentiment and this general direction throughout the administration, the big question that's been on a lot of people's minds and lips since the Rohingya genocide even, is what action could or would the United States feasibly take? When we talk about the atrocities that are being committed, I mean, we know now during this conflict period just how many terrible atrocities are being committed against ethnic minority groups. And we know full well the atrocities that were being committed before this coup was initiated. But is there anything that the United States can really do with regards to the victims of this, or can do with regards to the perpetrators of these crimes, that is not just symbolic, but that is much more tangible?
I mean, a couple of things. One of the key parts of the Burma Gap Act is that it authorizes money for a range of Burma-related programs, particularly humanitarian relief for refugees, but also other money for, you know, investigating atrocities, whether against the Rohingya or against other ethnic minorities in Burma. And again, this is a little bit more of getting under the hood of how Congress works. When Congress authorizes money, authorization is not appropriation. Okay. So authorizing the money doesn't actually appropriate the money. It simply shows what Congress wants in terms of, you know, kind of broader brush spending by the administration. The money will get appropriated in the State and Foreign Operations Appropriations Bill, which is one of the many appropriations bills that Congress is working on right now that should be passed by the fall. So, you know, one of the things I think is important to underline is this difference in authorization and appropriation, because while authorizations do set the direction and sort of broader policy lines of what the U.S. should be spending its money on, they don't actually appropriate the money. That's actually done in the appropriations bills. But then we have the problem that we've had for like about a decade, in that the appropriations process in Congress is fundamentally broken. And you see that in the fact that many appropriations bills simply haven't been passed for a number of years. And what Congress has done instead is cobble together a continuing resolution that throws all the appropriation bills into one big bucket, and then they just ram that thing through Congress so that the government doesn't shut down. Okay. Now, when we last had a State and Foreign Operations Appropriations Bill, we did very well for Burma. What we had with that was we had a House version of that and a Senate version of that, which were reconciled and into one bill. And the House passed a State and Foreign Operations Appropriations Bill, as it's called, SFOPs. The House SFOPs had less money for Burma-related programs, I think like $50 million, and the language of it, you know, directing how that spending should be made was not as good as the language in the Senate version of the bill, which also had more money, I think it's like up to about $126 million for Burma-related programs. And we did a big campaign when the bill was being reconciled to tell the Senate and House Appropriations Committee leaders who were reconciling these two bills to clearly use the Senate language on Burma, not the House language. We just wanted the House language ditched, and we just wanted the Senate language. And so, the Senate chair at the time of the Appropriations Committee was Senator Patty Murray. And again, we got constituents in Washington State to sit down with Senator Patty Murray's staff and say, when you're reconciling this bill, we want the Senate language, not the House language. The American Baptists, they got a number of pastors in Texas, both Burmese and non-Burmese, to write to the then House chair of the Appropriations Committee, Kay Granger, who was from Texas, again to say, we want the Senate language on Burma, not the House language. And we got that. In the final reconciled bill, it was the Senate language. It was not the House language. And that was a huge win. So that's how we work the appropriations process, is again, we're getting all of our champions in Congress to weigh in with the chair and ranking members of the Appropriations Committee as they reconcile these bills come out with the best language they could possibly get and the most amount of money for Burma-related programs. So that's the appropriations process, okay? But now we're facing the situation where Congress is appropriating money and the administration is not spending it. This is new. This is new. I mean, we're seeing this across the board, and we saw that with, you know, the administration closing down USAID, and just cutting all of these programs, including a number of key Burma-related programs by USAID, and basically not spending the money that Congress appropriated, and this is becoming a big, you know, constitutional issue, battle between Congress and the administration over appropriations. And again, this is like another one of these big waves on this unprecedentedly stormy sea that we're trying to navigate in our little Burma policy boat, right? So that's why I sort of recognize a little bit of caution on the passage of the Burma Gap Act through the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Is that number one, yep, it contains money for Burma-related programs, but it merely authorizes that money. It doesn't appropriate it. And the new problem we have now is, even if we get Congress to appropriate money for Burma-related programs, now have the problem that this administration may decide not to spend it. So that is the new problem that we're having to face. And again, I think, you know, what we can do faced with this is continue to do what we have successfully do and increasingly successfully done, lobby our members of Congress, make sure they're hearing from their districts, from their voters, that they want these bills, they want these appropriations for Burma, and in turn increase the pressure by Congress on the administration for the executive actions that we want on sanctions, and also for the spending on Burma-related programs that Congress actually appropriates, and just keeping up the pressure. I don't know how this is all going to play out, but I think nobody can really predict what's going to happen in Washington or the United States right now. But all I know is that we can continue to organize, we can continue to do what we do successfully, and we can put our best foot forward, and we can do, you know, we can do everything that we possibly can to influence U.S. policy on Burma.
I think you've sort of recapitulated that very very eloquently, but there are a sort of few niggling questions that I have about that one. There, the first one is, where is the money? If the money was appropriated by Congress and the administration chooses to not spend it, that doesn't then sort of become a windfall for the administration to spend how they like. Does the money sort of sit in escrow?
That's a good question, actually. I'm not sure.
Unprecedented indeed.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think it basically sits in the Treasury. I don't know. Because this is a problem around what's called impoundment, right? Mm-hmm. Impoundment is when the administration impounds or refuses to spend money that Congress has appropriated. And the administration, by doing that, may well be violating the Impoundment Act that was passed when Nixon was president, because that's one of the things that President Nixon tried to do, was impound money, but Congress passed the Impoundment Act to prevent the administration from doing that. But again, you know, we're in new political and constitutional territory here in the US. How this plays out, I'm not sure.
Mm. But yeah, so the other one is with refugees specifically. So obviously, this is not one of those cases where we have to analyze the legislation in very granular, microscopic terms, because the intention of the legislation is not necessarily to be applied in the strictest sense. It is to more generally push forward the pro democratic and pro civilian agenda. But with regard to refugees, there is an interesting situation going on here. We have a lot of Burmese refugees in surrounding countries, notably Thailand, and the Thai authorities have a very negative relationship with these refugee communities, many of whom are you know, hiding from authorities. They're being, you know, very severely abused. They're being shaken down for money. They're being arrested and sent back to Myanmar, where they're obviously facing life-threatening circumstances. The question with a bill like this, when it says that it makes money available for refugees, which by legal definition have to have crossed an international border to be recognized as refugees, how would that actually work? Because I presume the United States is not offering, especially not under the current administration, to rehome all of these refugees in the United States proper. But in many of the places where these refugees find themselves, the governments are quite hostile, and they might take a very dim view of the United States putting money into a community that they would much rather not have within their borders in the first place. What would the hypothetical interaction be there?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how this would play out. But one of the points that you're making, I think, is a very good one, is the fact that the US has now stopped resettling Burmese refugees in the US greatly diminishes the US's leverage on those countries that are hosting these refugees. And this is quite frankly part of this current administration's abdication of US leadership around the world, not just Burma. All I can say is, I think that you know, while we fight this here in DC, and fight this tough fight as best that we can, I think we've got to realize that when it comes to Burma-related policy, whether it's around whether it's about refugees in Thailand or in Bangladesh or other countries, we need the UK, the European Union, the Australian government, Canada. These countries are going to have to take on much more of a leadership role on Burma than they have before. You know, the US has been a real leader within the international community in support of democracy and human rights in Burma, and now that is in question. Burma policy as a whole from this administration is in question. We don't know if there's going to be continuity of policy from previous administrations. This is the big uncertainty that we're dealing with. And I think regardless of what the policy is going to be, you're not going to see the same amount of leadership from the US in the international community as we have seen before. And so that means the UK, the European Union, Australia, Canada will have to step up in more future.
I mean, certainly we hope that they will, but unfortunately, you know, echoing what the United States has done with regard to the rehousing of refugees, I know that Australia has made it much, much, much harder for anyone from Burma to come here on any type of visa, on the presumption that they are what is called a non-genuine temporary migrant. And I know that the European Union is doing much the same. I think the United Kingdom is doing much the same at the moment. It's it seems to be the standard play across the Western world to presume that people coming from war-torn countries are always just trying to be duplicitous in their visa applications and are just trying to find some sort of way to enter the country so that they can stay permanently. And heaven forbid that people from war-torn countries should find a way to leave war-torn countries. But that seems to be the way to go. And do you think that there is any way that the United States might reverse that direction? Because I strongly suspect that without the United States reversing this position, the other countries that you've mentioned and the European Union might be much more hesitant to reverse this position as well. Is there any chance under the current administration that there could be a softening of the attitude towards resettlement of refugees?
I really do not expect that at all.
That's what I was afraid of.
Yep. I mean, this administration this administration is never going to accept refugees from around the world unless in some weird specific circumstances, like, for instance,
South Africa.
The white Afrikaners from South Africa. Yep.
Yeah.
You're not going to see that. You're not going to see that from this administration.
All right. Fair. I mean, it's good to know what the circumstances are. It's good to get a realistic analysis of them.
That is the ground. That is the ground truth.
Yes. So with that, I think I think we've had a relatively holistic overview of these bills, and I think the most fascinating from my perspective, and I think for a lot of the audience, is going to be just the understanding that that the function of a bill is not necessarily contained within the actual words of the bill and the hope that those are going to be enacted into law, but that it can be a very persuasive tool within the administration and within broadly the political establishment.
Well, I would just I'd like to leave it on a moment of a thought of hope based on experience. And that is, you know, we've been able to see a lot of successes. In the last 30 years I've been working on this, you know, we've been able to, as citizens and as consumers of companies, we've been able to put a lot of effective pressure on our elected officials to do right by Burma and do right by the Burmese people. We've been able to use our economic power to put pressure on companies to stop supporting the junta. We've gotten, you know, over 100 companies we got to withdraw from Burma in the past through sanctions, but through putting consumer pressure, shareholder pressure, and media and social media pressure on companies. We have a lot of power as citizens, as consumers, and we've used that effectively, and we can continue to use that every day by contacting our members of Congress, contacting our elected officials in other countries, and by putting pressure on companies directly that support the junta. And let's continue to do that. People should feel free to check out our website, Campaign for a New Myanmar, where we have actions that people can take. Whether it's 5 or 10 minutes a day, all of this really adds up. You know, it can take sometimes just one letter, one phone call from a constituent to get a member of Congress to co-sponsor a bill. And so, you know, anyone listening here who lives in the U.S., contact your member of Congress today, get them to co-sponsor the Brave Burma Act. Check to see if they've already co-sponsored it. If they have, just call them up and thank them. We don't do that enough. But what we do matters. It has always mattered. It has been proven to matter. It has been proven to change things for the better. And let's continue to do that. Thank you.
In a world where Myanmar's crisis has largely faded from the headlines, critical voices and perspectives are often left unheard. And that's where we hope to come in. Through this humble platform, we're trying to provide something unique, an opportunity to share important experiences, insights, struggles, and perspectives in depth and in a way that few other media sources offer. Our content not only keeps the sputtering global conversation about Myanmar alive, but it also brings much-needed attention to those now fighting for their freedom and dignity. So if you value this work and the perspectives we're offering, please consider supporting us. Your contributions help us to continue to amplify those voices and provide the world with the coverage Myanmar so desperately deserves. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to stand with us.
Oh, ba, yara nanda, yara nanga, 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 yara nanga